The Netflix series The Crown will be returning to Netflix with season 2 on Friday. The DVD of season 1 just came out. It also is all timed with the Queen and Prince Philip just celebrating their 70th wedding anniversary late last month. Robert Lacey is a renowned British historian, the author of numerous international bestsellers, and the historical consultant on Netflix, The Crown. For nearly 40 years, Robert Lacey has been writing about Queen Elizabeth II and her extraordinary life, making him an expert of her long reign. Majesty, his biography of the Queen, is a definitive study of British monarchy, a subject on which Robert lectures around the world, appearing regularly on television. His new book is The Crown, The Official Companion, Volume 1, Elizabeth II, Winston Churchill, and the Making of a Young Queen, 1947 to 1955. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Robert Lacey to the roundtable this morning. Robert, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
What brought you to want to do this? Obviously, you have written a lot about the royals. You have written a lot about your country's history. What brought you to this particular project?
Well, I've been working for 4 years now on the Crown as an historical consultant, right from the beginning of the project. And as we gathered more and more material, I'm not the only historical person. There are 7 or 8 researchers involved full time, but I'm the person that Peter Morgan turns to when he wants to know, what did Elizabeth II, when she was a little princess, what did she call her daddy? Did she call him daddy, or did she call him something else? And the answer is Papa. or he said to me recently, look, we're doing Princess Margaret, all these scandalous stories. But do we call her Margaret or do we call her Margot? Because Diana, Princess Diana, used to call her Margot. So is that what the family call her? So I do some research and discover that when he was a little boy, Prince Charles couldn't pronounce Margaret. And so he always called her Aunt Margot. And so Diana picked that up. But that's just what that side of the family called her. Mm. Everybody else called her Margaret. So that was my job. That is my job. And as the show came on air last year and was so successful, but we discovered that record numbers of people were clicking on Google and Wikipedia as they watched it. Did the Queen really become Queen when she was up in the tree in Africa? And when she had her constitutional history lessons, did she really have a raven hopping round as though it was Harry Potter's study? And when her father died in England and she was up the tree, did this eagle come and hover magically as if passing the baton to her? Well, actually, yes, all these things happened, but it's quite complicated to explain. You can't explain it all on the screen, and so that's what the book does. It tells you the history, and then it also tells you some of the things that are imagined at the same time.
Well, that's it. That was one of the things that I thought was so interesting about the book, because it is so historically accurate, the series, and yet, because you're telling this very complicated story in 10 episodes or whatever for a decade, that indeed you have to make up some things, I assume, just for the flow of the program.
Yes. I mean, in episode 8, people will probably remember the wonderful row between Elizabeth and Philip when they're in Australia on tour and getting jaded with all the strain of it.
Oh, let me get out! Get out! Me, woman.
And they're in a bungalow waiting to do a photo opportunity with some koala bears. And this is true. There was a camera trained on the door and waiting for them to come out. But when the door opened, out came Prince Philip, pursued by the tennis racket and the shoes, hurled by a furious Queen who was chasing after Philip, shouting. Well, we know that happened because, as I say, it was filmed at the time by an Australian TV crew who then very loyally opened the camera and exposed the film so the Queen was not embarrassed.
I'm sorry, that little interlude. Although I'm sure it must happen in every marriage. Now, what would you like me to do?
For your newsreel.
Another gift for your Majesty.
I checked on that. It's actually written about in a PhD thesis by an Australian scholar whom I got in touch with across the world to make sure it was all true. So, but to come back to your question, Joe, about imagination, we know that happened, and so we depicted it. But we don't know what happened to the other side of the door. What was it that inspired this terrible row? And so at that point, we have to imagine, and we imagined Prince Philip getting so frustrated he started lighting up a cigarette, which he'd given up recently. His queen, the wife, got furious and said, "You're supposed to give up smoking. It killed my father." And he says, "Yes, I know it killed your father. I bet your father said I'll smoke 40 a day, so I die of cancer. I'd rather die of cancer than do bloody tours like this." Now, that, I have to say and confess, Joe, is totally imagined.
Who is it you think you'll be letting down anyway? A koala? This whole thing is a circus. It's a miserable circus, trudging from town to town with the dancing bears.
But we have to imagine what provoked the row, and so that's what the historical dramatist puts in.
So let me ask this question, because when you look at studying the history, and you said you would go and do your research, how open is the monarchy in the sense that you can actually find the answers to the questions that you're looking for? Because we think of it as somewhat secretive, but is there an openness there that allows you to know what happened at particular times?
Well, I have to say that since the first series has come out, and Buckingham Palace, and we don't know if you're going to ask me, I know, has the Queen watched this? And I'm going to have to tell you now, I don't know. But we know that people around the Queen have watched it. They feel it's a pretty sincere and thorough attempt to get to the truth. So, we are getting help. But we didn't need it. I mean, we are not on a retainer from Buckingham Palace or anything. And
no.
In fact, with these episodes, this particular period that I discuss in my book, 47 to 55, from the marriage of Elizabeth to the retirement of Winston Churchill, whom, as you know, is such a major figure in these early series, we can rely on what we call in Britain the 50-year rule, whereby any document, any official document, including royal documents, more than 50 years old, we can see. So, for example, we can see the arguments around the committee table discussing the coronation, with Prince Philip saying, it's a modern era, we've got to televise this. Winston Churchill and the others, the stuffier old people, saying no. And so we have got a lot of documentary evidence, although, of course, as the series moves on, we're moving into areas where more and more we rely on people who are still alive, happily, and will tell us the inside story of what happened.
I realize this is subjective, but it was my takeaway from watching the first series that Prince Philip isn't the most likable guy in the world.
Joe, you wouldn't expect me to agree with that, but between the lines, I think you're right.
There's no need to matronize me.
I'm not matronizing you.
Yes, you are. You're taking pity on me and giving me a job for appearance's sake.
No, it's not that. I was just thinking how I'd like us to spend more time together.
What are you talking about? We spend all our time together.
No, we don't. You're always off flying or lunching with strange men.
Well, a few hours a week, darling. Anyway, what else am I supposed to do? Sit around and wait for you while you're queening?
Queening?
Yes, queening.
Maybe I'd like your help with the queening.
Oh, in the same flattering way you asked me to redecorate Clarence House.
Well, you did that jolly well.
I felt like a sissy. Fussing about curtain fabrics and paint, Charles. Honestly, it's just queening of another sort.
One of the themes of the series, and you'll see this in season two, which is starting, how the rough edges get knocked off him. Now they're a devoted couple. This month they're celebrating 70 years of marriage. And that's a marriage where the love has actually got stronger. Season two, which is coming up, we'll see some question marks over the relationship. Was he totally faithful? Was there a rift in the royal marriage, as the newspapers alleged and as Buckingham Palace denied? And without giving anything away, we'll see how the couple work that out. But to go back to your question, yes. I mean, this was a rough young, he was a prince, but, he didn't have much more to his name than a cardboard suitcase. And there were those who suggested that his marriage to Elizabeth was of a young man on the make. because his previous royal connections in Denmark and Greece had found it. And in a way, his relationship with the Queen was the making of him. And also, let's be fair to him, as people who have seen the series know, he's got this career as a naval officer. He and Elizabeth are very happy out in Malta, enjoying a fairly normal life. And then, tragically, George VI gets cancer. They have to come back. He has to give up his naval career. They've just built this lovely home for themselves, Clarence House, not far from the palace. They think, well, let's stay there and we'll go and use the palace as an office. Winston Churchill says no. And then the greatest problem for Prince Philip, pride-wise, was that when he married the Queen, she took his name as Mountbatten. It was agreed by the authorities. She was a woman. She took her husband's name. And so Elizabeth, when she came to the throne, was actually Elizabeth Mountbatten, not Elizabeth Windsor. And when in the series we see Lord Mountbatten raise a toast to the House of Mountbatten that now rules, he was quite correct. But then, as we also see in the series, and you know, again, that's the point of the book. The book goes into the documentation side of this. Queen Mary, who was one of the creators of the House of Windsor back in 1917, said, no way, it's not going to be the House of Mountbatten. It's going to be Windsor, like it always has been, or it has been for the last 50 years. And so we see how both Elizabeth and Philip have to submit to this. So, again, to answer your question at great length, maybe he was rough, maybe he was angry, but as we show, he had a few good reasons for being aggrieved.
Meanwhile, the takeaway, at least for me, was that the Queen, taking over the throne at the age of 25, being thrown into this so young, having this unexpected, it just seems to be the theme over and over and over again that becomes obvious is how she rises to the occasion.
Yes, she rises to the occasion, usually by subjecting and submitting her personal desires to duty. That's a big theme of our early episodes. It's a big theme of the book. And I think in the bigger picture, it's one of the reasons why people respond to her across the world. I mean, because she's someone who's done her duty, who's stuck it through, always subjected her personal wishes to the demands of her situation, which is, of course, to represent the best of Britain in any circumstances. And you know, if I may do a bit of shouting on behalf of Britain here, you know, often American friends say to me, that's a crazy system got over there, old-fashioned monarchy, and then the prime minister. And I say, on the contrary, it's a much more sensible system than you've got in America, because our system separates what we call the dignified from the executive. You can disagree with what the executive is doing, what the prime minister is doing, but if the dignified side, if the Queen and the royal family are doing their duty and upholding what the country values, then you remain loyal and patriotic. And you, in your country, every 4 years, you elect somebody to do both jobs. When Barack Obama was elected, there were white people in the South who didn't feel happy with a black man representing in America. And now, well, now you've got someone else, and you know, people feel unhappy that this man should represent the best of America. Well, perhaps you should go back to the old days and try splitting the two. And although, of course, every president you've got wants to be a monarch.
Well, maybe some more than others, right? Some enjoy the pageantry, perhaps, a little bit more than the others. Let me ask you, we've been talking about history. Let me ask you about television here, which is, my goodness, it seems like you all got so incredibly lucky in the finding of the talent of Claire Foy, who plays the Queen.
Well, we did.
At the time of my education, I asked the Vice Provost if we shouldn't spend a bit of time on literature, philosophy, science. He felt I had enough on my plate as it was. But don't you think I should have learned about it?
Why?
Well, doesn't one have a duty to know certain things?
You have a great many other virtues. Can't be expected to know everything.
Well, no, that's the point, Mummy. I know almost nothing.
You know when to keep your mouth shut. That's more important than anything.
And that would have been fine if I'd gone on to live a normal life.
It's not just accident. Claire is only our queen for two episodes.
Correct.
Season two is coming, and that will end in 1964, and that'll be the end of Claire, I'm afraid. And there will be a new queen. There will be a new Prince Philip. In fact, the whole cast will be transformed. And that's for two reasons. One, so that, yes, they don't have to get aged with makeup, but that we just pick older actors. It's already known that the successor to Claire will be a wonderful English actress about 10 years older than her called Olivia Colman, big star in England and I think destined to be a big star over here. But the other thing is, by only casting for 2 years, you can get actresses of real talent like Claire. An actress of her caliber doesn't want to sign up for a soap opera for 10 years and get typecast. And so I think that's another reason for one of the part of the appeal of The Crown, that we are able, we got a cadre of really wonderful, best of English talent. And we brought in an American, John Lithgow, to play Churchill, who, of course, did it so brilliantly. He's been, I think he did get an Oscar for it.
Emmy Award, yeah.
An Emmy, sorry. It's not up to the Oscars.
I understand you've rejected the painting.
I have.
On what grounds?
That is not a painting. It's a humiliation. How shall I paint him today? Sitting on a chair, producing a stool. A broken, sagging, pitiful creature, squeezing and squeezing.
That's not how it's being seen.
That is how it is, and I will not accept it.
I don't think it's wise to reject it. It was commissioned by the members of the Joint Houses of Parliament as a sign of respect.
But then they should have commissioned an artist who is respectful instead of a Judas wielding his murderous brush. Look at it! It is a betrayal of friendship and an unpatriotic, treacherous, cowardly assault by the individualistic left.
As regards the friendship...
Clearly, there is none.
And, of course, he did cause us some problems because being a big, strong American, he's about 15-20% bigger than Churchill was. And so all the doors in the Downing Street set had to be made 15-20% larger so that he was shown to scale. And that, if I may say so, is part of the attention to detail we're so proud of on the series.
Well, the other thing, too, is a lot has been made about the cost of production of this show. But my goodness, does it show on the screen? It is an expensive production, and it looks it.
Thank you. And we've just been working. You'll see in season two, there's a whole episode on the Queen and Jackie Kennedy and the sort of rivalry between the two of them in their different styles. And we were doing a lot on this wonderful photograph of Jackie and the Queen together and copying their costumes exactly. And then somebody looked closer and said, look, the wristwatch is on the wrong hand, on the wrong wrist. Oh, yeah, and look at that brooch, it's on the wrong side. And the negative we were working from, the picture of being transposed. We have to go back to square one, but that's part of the challenge of getting all the details absolutely right.
You know, I just have to say as we wrap up, and I know we've been talking about the Queen, of course, and the Crown and the new book, I first became familiar with your work with a book that you wrote in the 80s, which was one of the best biographies I ever read, which was on the Fords.
Thank you.
On Henry Ford and the making of and that family. And it was just so eye-opening, and I just think it's interesting, of course, you being a Brit and a renowned British historian, that you found this piece of American history and wrote it so beautifully.
Well, thank you, Joe. I think what I brought to that story about the Fords, which was one of my most successful books, yes, Ford, The Men and the Machine, it was actually made into a TV miniseries, was that I approached it from the family point of view, which is actually, if anything, is my specialty. I've also written books on Saudi Arabia. And if you want to, I always say to people, if you want to understand Saudi Arabia, you have to understand it's a monarchy, an absolute monarchy at that. And, you know, there's a lot of fuss at the moment about this new young crown prince shaking things up.
Right.
He's being compared to Putin. You don't compare him to Putin. You compare him to Peter the Great. You compare him to the great autocrats like Louis XIV. He's that in the 21st century. And, you know, that family dimension is what I try to bring to The Crown and to this book about it.
Well, the name of the book is The Crown. It is the official companion. And Robert, I thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure having you on the program. I wish you all the luck in the world, and thank you for the great work.
Thank you, Joe, and let's enjoy the next season of The Crown together on opposite sides of the Atlantic.
Again, the name of the book is The Crown, The Official Companion, Volume 1, Elizabeth II, Winston Churchill and the Making of a Young Queen, 1947 to 1955. Season 2 of The Crown starts on Friday on Netflix. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.